about a possible deal for Hart's 30 years of solo recordings at the Capitol Tower in Hollywood. Woz had been working on a record with pop star John Mayer and knew of Mayer's fascination with the dead. Mayer happened to be downstairs in the basement recording studio, and Woz called him up to meet Weir and Hart. Mayer was a misunderstood pop star. He vaulted up from the pop charts at age 19 in 2002 with his first album, Room for Squares, a smooth, frankly commercial pop album that threw off several hit singles, including Your Body is a Wonderland, which won a Grammy. Although success came easily to him, he remained, obviously, someone with something left to prove. His 2006 album, Continuum, was an acclaimed, popular bid to be taken more seriously as a musician, an aspiration Mayer managed to swiftly undermine with a series of gaffes, public romances turned ugly, and awkward interviews. Plagued with medical issues involving his throat, Mayer disappeared with his next album half finished. He spent more than 2 years without singing in public. He relocated to Bozeman, Montana, and apparently underwent considerable self-examination. When he returned in April 2013 to induct the late bluesman Albert King into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Mayer brought his guitar to the podium and gave a short postdoctoral seminar on electric blues guitar styles, underscoring his emergence as a guitar-playing rock musician rather than a sulky pop singer. Don Was produced Mayer's comeback 2013 album, Paradise Valley, a sortie into folk rock inspired by the Laurel Canyon scene of the early 70s, CSNNY, Joni Mitchell, etc. It was another plea to be taken more seriously. During the sessions for Paradise Valley, Mayer became obsessed with the Grateful Dead. He stumbled across Althea, listening to the internet music service Pandora, and, captivated by Garcia's guitar lick, followed the song down the entire Grateful Dead rabbit hole. He soon had downloaded every Dick's Picks to his iPod and was compulsively studying the Dead's music. Woz, producer of Mayer's album, had no idea the collaboration he was facilitating in his office when he called Mayer upstairs to meet his heroes. Mayer, an intense and articulate young man, bubbled over. He went into a speech about how much he admired their music. He told them he came to the music fresh, with no cultural association. Nobody would ever mistake Mayer for a hippie. He wanted them to understand how he saw their music on his own, free from the tie-dye and psychedelics. He said the songs took him places he never went before, and now he visited every day. He might have gotten a little carried away. It sounded a bit like a sermon. These are songs for people with homes who every so often don't want those homes, Mayer told them. Hey, you want to do our PR? Said Weir. After that meeting, Mayer invited Weir to be his guest during a stint as acting host of television's The Late Late Show in February. After the obligatory interview where Mayer explained that he converted to the Dead's music at the height of his vocal cord problems, I couldn't even speak at the time, and the music just found me, the two picked up guitars and plugged Althea, the song that introduced Mayer to the Dead, and Truckin'. Mayer's liquid guitar lines gelled with Weir's crystalline cording. Weir was taken. There's no way I'm not going to play music with that guy again, he told Matt Bush as they left the television studio. In March, Mayer went to TRI at Weir's invitation for a week of jamming. Dead drummers Hart and Kreutzmann looked at the sessions as an opportunity for a sectional rehearsal in front of Fare Thee Well, since Lesh had decreed there would be only a minimum number of full band rehearsals. With Mike Gordon of Fish on bass and Mayer producer Don Was on keyboards, the band arrived ready to work out on the half-dozen Dead songs that Mayer came prepared to play. Peter Shapiro was at TRI that morning. The overwhelming demand for the Soldier Field shows had blown everybody away. When tickets for the general public finally went on sale, Fare Thee Well broke the internet. More than a half million people were waiting online to buy tickets when Ticketmaster opened for business that morning. Ticketmaster sold out the more than 200,000 tickets in less than an hour. It was the biggest single one-day rock concert sale in the company's history. They figured they could have sold 6 million tickets. Shapiro's $2,200 VIP enhanced experience packages featuring floor seats, private lounge, and food and drink were snapped up instantly. More than 86% of the tickets were sold outside Illinois. The secondary market was sizzling. StubHub featured several sets of tickets to all three shows for $11,000. A private suite was available for $20,000. The average resale price was more than $600. Shapiro was scrambling to meet the extraordinary demand and had convinced the band to consider two additional shows prior to the Chicago shows as West Coast warm-ups. Shapiro, Matt Bush, and Amy Kreutzmann drove down that morning to check out the new football stadium built by the San Francisco 49ers football team in Santa Clara County. Located in the heart of Silicon Valley, near the city of Mountain View, the billion-dollar Levi's Stadium had only opened the previous season. No concerts had yet been held in the facility, but country star Kenny Chesney was booked into the stadium the coming May. Only a few miles from Palo Alto, where the Grateful Dead first came together, the area had changed dramatically since those sleepy days. The tech industry that flowered in little cubbyholes around that part of the peninsula, about the same time as the Dead did, had blossomed into America's great new industry and radically transformed the surrounding area, partially fueled by the same psychedelic soup as the Grateful Dead. It was a long way from Magoo's Pizza Parlor on El Camino Real in Menlo Park now. Shapiro and the party toured the spanking new stadium and decided they could do the shows there. When Bush phoned back to TRI to tell Weir they had cut the deal for the additional concerts, the band was already playing, and he left word with Weir's wife, Natasha. None of the musicians at TRI knew why they were there, but the music they were making together was convincing. Weir's sonic marvel of a studio allowed them to explore the subtleties of their music at comfortable volumes and exquisite fidelity. By the end of the week, they had decided to form a band. On one hand, whatever plans they would make would have to wait until after the Fare Thee Well shows in July. On the other hand, if somehow the plans for the reunion faltered, a possible backup was now in place. While the band members had all agreed to Shapiro's proposals, they had still not come together in person. Drummer Kreutzmann and his wife Amy had temporarily relocated to San Francisco early in the year. They took an apartment in the former industrial neighborhood, Turning Hip, Dogpatch, a far cry from the north shore of Kauai. Kreutzmann's book was coming out in May, and the Fare Thee Well event would be in July. He wanted to play music. He had been locked up in Hawaii since 2012, working on the book with journalist Benji Eisen, who was now serving as Kreutzmann's manager. He had vowed not to play music until the book was done. Outside of one existing obligation in Belize and Costa Rica in January 2013, called Jungle Jam, for which he fielded a version of BK3, his Billy Kreutzmann trio, he had been good to his word. His days in Kauai could be bucolic. He lived with his wife in his rambling former bachelor pad, a pool house set on lush grounds, a couple of miles from where his wife maintained the organic farm she operated before they met. They were building a new home on the lot next to the farm. Kreutzmann liked to get up early and perform light chores around the place. They hired farm workers for the hard work, but Kreutzmann enjoyed pitching in. When wild pigs became a problem, they set traps and ate boar for weeks. The farm ran a fruit stand, and he took a particular interest in its operation. He also liked to go fishing or scuba diving off his boat, typical daily pursuits of life in the Hawaiian paradise, not to mention the occasional psychedelic camping trip. Although he wasn't playing music while he worked on the book, he and Eisen would eat mushrooms and listen to old Dead tapes. When Rat Dog had canceled their tour after Weir's crash the previous summer, an opportunity suddenly arose for Kreutzmann to play the Lock-In Festival. Eisner put him together with keyboardist Aaron Magner of the Disco Biscuits, an old friend of Eisen's, and guitarist Tom Hamilton. Kreutzmann brought guitarist Steve Kamak, bassist Oteil Burbage, and other guests, including Taj Mahal and Colonel Bruce Hampton, for what they called the Lock-In Step All-Stars. The well-received set was lauded by reviewers as one of the highlights of the festival. Fresh from that triumph, with Magner and Hamilton on board, and bassist Reed Mathis of jam band Tea Leaf Green, Kreutzmann started Billy and the Kids early the next year, after landing in San Francisco, and took the band on the road in April. He also paused for a week at New Orleans Jazz Fest in May, with a couple of the Little Feet musicians, in an impromptu outing they called Dead Feet. On top of all that, he spent 2 weeks on a book tour in May, doing signings and media interviews for his freshly published memoir, Deal, My 3 Decades of Drumming, Dreams and Drugs with the Grateful Dead. Experienced touring musicians who meet the book tour are often flabbergasted by how much more exhausting it is than rock tours because, on the road with a rock band, you don't have to get up early to do morning TV talk shows. After more than 2 years of quiet isolation on the islands, Kreutzmann was busting out of his rock fever. Kreutzmann was a primal man. His life in Hawaii was quasi-retirement, a blend of leisure and boredom only available to someone who could afford it. As much as he liked drumming, music was not his lifeblood, and, outside of playing drums, there was not much he was driven to do. Life on Kauai could be idyllic, but he had no support system to rival what he left in Marin. Living on the most remote islands on the planet can be confining and depressing, but every day is paradise. Kreutzmann always liked to blur the line between play and work. After Garcia's death, he had gone full Trapo, and outside of occasional patches of loneliness and isolation, the island lifestyle largely suited him. Only now, he was itching for activity. In May, all four men almost crossed paths at Dear Jerry, a Garcia commemorative concert held at Meriwether Post Pavilion in Columbia, Maryland. Early on, it was decided that they would save any joint appearances for Fare Thee Well, so Lesh opened the show as Phil Lesh and Communion, with his sons and the band, and left to catch an early flight. The 4.5-hour all-star concert also featured New Orleans songwriter Alan Toussaint, Garcia Bluegrass associate David Grisman, Jamaican reggae star Jimmy Cliff, country singer Eric Church, alt-rock princess Grace Potter, Garcia's favorite East L.A. Mex rockers Los Lobos, 70s rock hero Peter Frampton, and others. Without Lesh at the end of the show, the other three, Weir, Hart, and Kreutzmann, came together for Touch of Grey and the ensemble finale of Ripple. Early flight or not, Lesh still managed to extend his opening set to the point where the entire day's schedule needed to be adjusted. Hart had never slowed down, and Fare Thee Well only interrupted his steady stream of activities. He was immersed in consuming, passionate projects at all times. He had begun recording another album, continued to create his artwork, and done music on the brain work with neurophysicist Dr. Adam Ghazali. He served on the boards of the National Recording Registry and the Exploratorium, a beloved San Francisco science museum. He was part drummer, part mystic, part swashbuckling Gandalf, bravely forging ahead, a force of nature unto himself. He and Kreutzmann were the yin and yang of the beat, Kreutzmann the steady, powerful beat, and Hart the imaginative, irresistible color. They were drum brothers under the hood of the rhythm together, a symphony of percussion at the heart of the Grateful Dead. Lesh didn't appear to see it that way. In further, he never replaced Jay Lane, indicating he didn't feel the second drummer was necessary to interpret Grateful Dead material. He treated Hart and Kreutzmann with a certain disdain. He seemingly saw the drummers as disposable and made no attempt to disguise his contempt. They returned the disrespect. To the drummers, being left out of further remained a wound that had not entirely healed. But that was hardly the beginning of the clash. This battle extended back through the years, but had only broken into the open when Hart made that liver of a jerk comment after Lesha's transplant. After that, relations between the Leshas and the drummers had been at best tenuous, wary, and terse. At worst, suspicious, combative, and hostile. A lot of bad blood had been spilled. Coming back together, even for this limited amount of time, was fraught with possible danger. That morning in June, driving to the first day of rehearsals at the soundstage the band rented in San Rafael, Hart felt undeniable excitement, but he also experienced considerable anxiety. He had not been in the same room with Lesh for a number of years now. They could both still feel the animosity, even at a distance. So much of Lesh's actions and statements had been hurtful. They cut Hart to the bone, and he had struck back. The conflict was a deep heartache for Hart, because Lesh had been Hart's best friend in the band after Kreutzmann brought him in. He had lived in the Belvedere Street house in the Hate with Lesh, sleeping in a closet. Lesh turned him onto the album The Music of North India, a recording that changed Hart's life, and, subsequently, the music of the Grateful Dead. Hart scarred the album cover dripping wax from candles as he struggled to read the liner notes in his dark closet. He and Lesh had shared the rhythm and the great adventure that was the Grateful Dead all their adult lives. Underneath the anger and recriminations were broken hearts. Hart wondered what was waiting for him as he pulled his black Porsche into the studio parking lot. 3210 Studio in San Rafael was a massive facility built by George Lucas's production company, Industrial Light and Magic. They shot pieces of Star Wars and Indiana Jones movies there. TRI was too small for the full-scale production they were planning to mount. Their equipment had been loaded in and set up. Vocal rehearsals with Weir, Lesh, Anastasio, and Bruce Hornsby had been taking place the previous 4 days. The quartet worked out the harmonies using only acoustic guitars and Hornsby on piano, who could feel his keyboards in the intimate, low-key music they were making, helping shape the songs. Lesh had insisted that he would only play 1 day of full band rehearsal for each show, a total of 5 days with the drummers. Considering Anastasio had to learn around 100 songs, it seemed unnecessarily difficult, and more rehearsals might have been indicated, but his bandmates had learned that Lesh would not negotiate. There had always been arguments about how much rehearsal was good for the band. Of course, only the Dead would worry about over-rehearsing in the first place. But Weir, Hart, and Kreutzmann were under no illusions that that was Lesh's reasoning on the Fare Thee Well rehearsals. They figured he simply wanted to avoid spending that much time with them. When Hart walked into the cavernous studio, his greatest fear materialized. Lesh was the only one who had arrived ahead of him, and they were alone. The awkward moment passed quickly. Lesh was immediately cordial and open. They gave each other a hug and exchanged witticisms. Hart felt his doubts ease and sat down behind his drums. For months, the musicians had been passing around a shared text of a list of songs they wanted to play. There was a second list of songs people didn't want to play, but nothing was ever added to that list. At rehearsal, with limited time to process a massive songbook, many numbers were discarded simply because they were too complex and would eat up too much rehearsal time. With more than 100 songs to consider, Lesh had proposed arranging the concerts in a chronological retrospective. Set lists for all the shows were written, although the band would tinker with the selections up to the last minute. Lash had been experimenting at Terrapin Crossroads with themed presentations concentrating on individual years from the dead's history. Studying the repertoire, using his club as a laboratory for Fare Thee Well. Only the week before, John Mayer had sat in at Terrapin, recreating two individual 1977 shows. Lesh knew he wanted to open the Soldier Field shows with Box of Rain, because that was the last song the Dead played at Soldier Field in 1995, and end the entire series of shows with Addicts of My Life. At the rehearsals, he took charge, strutting around like a rooster, ruling on other people's ideas, snapping off terse orders to his equipment handlers. Lesh was clearly nervous. Everyone was. He threw off tense vibes, which were intimidating and uncomfortable to both crew and musicians. The air was fraught with electricity. Hart grew frustrated, tinkering with his drum sound, and exploded, throwing a stick at his equipment guy. The atmosphere between Weir and Lesh could become charged. Weir balked at Lesh's bullying, clearly still a sore spot from further, but the touch-and-go moments came and went. There was too much work to be done for much disagreement, and, for the most part, the musicians concentrated on the daunting enough tasks at hand. Guitarist Anastasio had been thrown in the briar patch. He started learning the songs on his own almost immediately after accepting the assignment in January. But before long, he hired Broadway pianist Jeff Tansky, who wrote charts for 70 songs and rehearsed daily with Anastasio in a Midtown Manhattan studio they locked out for the duration. He spent 3 days in March with Weir at his Stinson Beach place, jogging the beach together in the mornings and strumming archtop guitars long into the night. Weir spent another few days with him in Marin in April, and again Manhattan after the Dear Jerry concert in May. After that, Anastasio came to Marin County in May for a couple of days playing with Lesh, even sitting in one night at Terrapin Crossroads. Attending a barbecue given by Lesh was Anastasio's first opportunity to witness the little brother-big brother dynamic between Lesh and Weir, even before he played with the two together. In between jams, the three of them sat around a table at Lesh's and worked on the set lists for the shows. The guitar parts were hard enough, but Anastasio had to practice his vocals without knowing which songs he would be assigned to sing lead or which harmony part he would be singing. Weir sang a lot of the old Garcia songs, and Lesh used to cover the high notes on the harmonies, but now he sang lower. Some parts were in different registers. There was no way for him to know until they all came together for rehearsal. Anastasio could not win. He had been given an impossible task, a job with failure built in. Not only did he have to learn and master a massive number of complicated songs that his bandmates all knew better than he did, he was standing in the place of Jerry Garcia, one of the most distinctive stylists to ever play an electric guitar, before some of the most critical and discriminating fans in rock. He would be faulted either way, if he sounded too much like Garcia or didn't sound enough like Garcia. And as much homework as he had done, it was pure fantasy to think he could ever be adequately prepared for such an extensive and complicated songbook. He was one courageous musician. Anastasio impressed everyone with his attitude. He proved he was a team player, even under such grueling conditions. He behaved like a guest, not the alpha bandleader he was in Fish. On breaks, he fussed endlessly with his guitar tone and swapped out gear in consultation with his guitar tech. Relentlessly upbeat, Anastasio was the kind of person who looked people in the eyes when they spoke. Quiet, gentle, and serious. But he was left largely to his own devices. Nobody was communicating with him. Keyboardist Comenti, who had played in every post-Garcia band, made an effort to be especially helpful with Anastasio, and, in fact, could often bring the whole band back to focus when they got lost. There was considerable debate over the stage plot. Weir wanted to stand beside Anastasio so they could more easily see what each other was doing. But Lesh insisted on holding down center stage. That meant the drummers had to endure the pounding volume of Lesh's amplifier, and a plexiglass divider was positioned between the drummers to partly dampen the sound. Weir reluctantly agreed to the arrangement to keep things running smoothly. Lesh and Weir also agreed to compromise on their volume versus tempo argument. The tension was largely lost in the pressure of rehearsing this enormous amount of material in such a short time. Breaks were short, and nobody hung around and socialized afterward. There wasn't a lot of easy camaraderie. The others might make comments about Lesh among themselves, but they would say nothing in front of him. There was a lot of talk about reducing the number of lead vocals Lesh was giving to himself and letting Anastasio sing more, but little came of that. The old animosities may have lingered, but they went unspoken. At this highlight of their careers, they simply would rather let Lesh have his way than possibly ruin everything by tangling with him. Even more than Hart, Kreutzmann harbored strong feelings toward Lesh. They circled each other warily the first couple of days, but Lesh broke the ice after getting worked into a froth by the pounding beat Kreutzmann was laying down. At the end of the number, Lesh leapt toward Kreutzmann's drum set and reached over for a congratulatory handshake over the kit. It was a small gesture and an awkward moment, but a genuine flush of enthusiasm from Lesh. At the sight of that exchange, Hart breathed deeply, confident now that they could pull this off. Chapter 21. Rainbow. There was no explaining the rainbow. Some immediately thought it was artificial, created by the wizards of Obscura Digital, the group who designed the magnificent light shows for Fare Thee Well. But it turned out Obscura was not behind it. An artificial rainbow would have to be projected on something, and this one was too high in the sky for that. Music industry trade magazine Billboard even reported the next day, incorrectly, that producers had paid $50,000 for the spectacle. But to everyone's complete amazement, the rainbow proved to be an authentic phenomenon. The Grateful Dead had always been a beacon for unexplained phenomena. They all well remembered the Portland, Oregon concert in June 1980, when nearby Mount St. Helens erupted during the band's concert, while they played, no lie, Fire on the Mountain. Concertgoers were showered in volcanic ash, leaving the abruptly canceled show. Or the 1987 concert in Telluride, Colorado, during the harmonic convergence. The Dead's cosmic consciousness invoked all kinds of strange and wondrous powers. But if the Deadheads needed a sign of validation to crown this convergence with an omen none could deny, they couldn't have asked for a more startling and satisfying one than the massive, arcing rainbow that encompassed the entire scene. A corona ringing the stadium, stage set, and band. Its appearance perfectly timed at the climax of the first Fare Thee Well set as the reunited Dead turned the corner and headed for the barn playing Viola Lee Blues. The band had arrived at Levi's Stadium outside Santa Clara on Friday afternoon to hold a 2-hour soundcheck that, in addition to a much-needed technical rehearsal, provided another useful practice session for the band. The production had come together quite quickly and rather chaotically in the final few weeks. Longtime Grateful Dead lighting designer Candace Brightman was brought in somewhat late in the day to confer with Shapiro and his production specialists. She found plans in disarray, the chain of command obscure, and a morass of email communications, more than 65 a day, that only spread the confusion. The first proposed stage design came from Mike Tate of Tate Towers, the stage construction and design firm that built massive stage sets for Madonna, the Rolling Stones, and Michael Jackson. Tate envisioned a gigantic, elaborate stage that would have cost more than $1 million. Brightman didn't like the stage design. She thought it was overdone, clumsy, and ungrateful dad-like. In spite of that, erroneous emails circulated saying that Brightman endorsed the design. She was bewildered by the lack of communication. There was no central organization, and Brightman could never figure out who was in charge of what. She had been told by management she could not speak to any of the band members unless they were all present, which made knowing their wishes difficult. Word eventually was handed down from the band that they wanted an industrial look, and Brightman went about a more rudimentary design that incorporated a simple proscenium decorated with roses and a large video screen. Obscura Digital, the high-tech outfit from San Francisco, created luminous, imaginative light projections for the proscenium. A computer model was used to build the stage, sound, and lights, and nobody knew how it would work or what it would look like until it was constructed and plugged in at Levi's the day before the first show. On their drive from Sebastopol, where they lived, to Levi's Stadium for the Friday afternoon soundcheck, Mickey Hart and his wife and daughter stopped at the water's edge in the Presidio in San Francisco to draw a deep breath and take a moment's respite before heading into battle. His wife, Carol, had to negotiate the time off from her job as park director of Sonoma County. The sun sparkled on the bay, and the ocean breeze cooled the air as the Harts took a break from the 3-hour drive for a brief family interlude. Where they were going, such private exchanges were going to be scarce. They were leaving serenity behind. At soundcheck, Bob Weir stepped out of the late afternoon shadows onto the giant stage at the end of the stadium and looked out at the empty field and grandstands yawning before him. It had been many years since the Dead commanded stadiums. He could not escape the feeling that what was about to occur was truly momentous. In many ways, his entire life had led to this place and this hour. More than the culmination of 20 years of struggle, a victory over immense adversity, an exultant triumph of spirit over flesh, this was the peak of a lifetime's path. Preparing to oversee the storied songbook he so intimately helped to create with his lifelong colleagues for one final remarkable occasion, Weir knew their hard-won rapprochement had brokered this tenuous peace and paved the way for a once-in-a-lifetime experience. In that moment, he stood on top of all that had been accomplished, and he determined to feel it in every cell of his body. The stadium was eerily quiet. With the perimeter of the stadium and parking lots surrounded by cyclone fencing and gates closed until the afternoon of the concert, the only people on the scene were worker bees buzzing around the hive. There were few hangers-on waiting in the wings as stagehands busily finished preparing the production. No crowds of deadheads, partying or partaking, camped out in the empty, quiet parking lots. As the sky turned orange and purple from the tie-dyed sunset, when the band finally assembled on stage and the first belches of electric guitar and eruptions of drums echoed from the stage, barely a soul paused to watch. The band cruised through Althea and Brown-Eyed Woman. They practiced the next night's opening selection, a 1-2 punch of Truckin' and Uncle John's Band. They tried out Cumberland Blues and ran St. Stephen with the William Tell Bridge into The Eleven. They went over the bridge a few times. The Lesh experimental piece, What's Become of the Baby, a studio track the Dead never performed live, was rehearsed and Cream Puff War, a song from the band's earliest days, was worked out several times. These songs all came straight from the Fillmore era, and for good measure, they trotted out the traditional set closer of the day, Turn On Your Love Light, the blues romp that was a specialty of the band's first blues singer and keyboardist, the beloved Pigpen, who died at age 27 in 1973. Weir had handled the song more than capably since 1981, when he reintroduced it to the band's repertoire. They even tried Alligator, another number from the band's early days, the Dead dropped from their songbook in 1971. Clearly, the legacy would be deeply plumbed. A couple of intrepid deadheads had sneaked into the stadium yard. In a 21st century touch, they recorded the rehearsal from outside the stadium and posted it on the internet. Shapiro quickly brought in the Phish security team, and they went nuts racing around the stadium trying to find the source of the broadcast and shut it down, but gave up when they realized it was coming from the parking structure across the street. On Saturday, the day of the show, with the perimeter fenced off and the lots not open until 3 in the afternoon, the customary Shakedown Street scene moved to a hotel parking lot a mile away. Still, when the fans began to trickle into the empty stadium from the official parking lots in the late afternoon, the crew couldn't help but be struck by what they saw. As these hippies of all ages filed through the turnstiles and onto the field, all hands recognized immediately that this was no ordinary rock concert crowd. It was not simply that they came in colorful raiment, festive moods, and buzzing with anticipation. They did all that, but this crowd was instantly special. Nobody had seen anything like it before. Unlike other concertgoers, they were quiet, peaceful, happy. They radiated joy. Shapiro had colored roses handed out to the first 45,000, and that helped set the tone. But it was the Deadheads who brought the party, and that was clear before the band ever set foot on stage. In fact, it was the Deadheads who willed this concert into existence. Their collective, conscious expectation of a giant celebration in honor of the 50th anniversary created the event. The musicians themselves were hardly in a sentimental mood about the good old Grateful Dead at the time, although they could not fail to notice the looming milestone. The mere fact that they were still alive was amazing enough. It was possible that the four living members had never been further apart in all their adult lives, but the force of the Deadheads pulled them together like an irresistible force. Between the power of the Deadheads and the allure of the music, the band encountered a complex siren song that even the most recalcitrant among them could not resist. Truth be told, the Deadheads also cast Trey Anastasio in the Garcia chair. All the other guitarists that the Dead had tried after Garcia, to one degree or another, had failed. Nobody could replace Garcia. Anastasio had barely played 10 minutes with any of the Dead musicians and didn't know the repertoire, but his status as the lead guitarist slash vocalist slash Garcia-like figure of the second generation's leading jam band made him the only obvious, non-controversial choice. In the history of a singular rock band who resolutely followed their own path and kept their own counsel, Fare Thee Well was the first time the Dead made decisions based on focus group studies, even if they were collected through the ether. At Levi's Stadium, the sheer size of the 70,000 capacity crowd was staggering enough, but the unified identity of the people attending lent the proceedings the uncanny, intimate, familial air of a high school graduation or church social more than a rock concert. Old friends came together. People ran into people they knew from past shows. For this one day, all these people would be friends who never met before, happily sharing this signal event that brought them together and gave them all common purpose. Stockbrokers who came in their Mercedes, street people who picked up a miracle ticket in the lots, everybody was a hippie for the day. Backstage was swarming with well-wishers, friends, and celebrities such as television's Andy Cohen, Deadhead ex-Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, Apple widow Lauren Jobs, rock star John Mayer, whose presence was a mystery to many, although the pending formation of a band between him and three of the core four qualified as one of the worst-kept secrets in Deadland. Mayer, who had hoped to sit in at the shows, had to be told there would be no special guests on this engagement. The two camps, the Leshes and the other ones, remained sharply divided. The dressing rooms were a metaphor for how fractured the band had become. In the stadium, signs pointed to dressing rooms for Weir, Hart and Kreutzmann in one direction and to the Lesch dressing room in the opposite direction. Walking the short stairs to the huge stage, flanked by VIP viewing areas, the men from the dead were finally ascending a hill they had spent many long years trudging up. Epiphanies of self-discovery, tests and trials, long days adrift at sea. Each man had both lost and found his true self, fought his own dragons, lashed himself to the mast, and ultimately proved his worth. This coming together had been written long before it happened, although it had been far from inevitable. These lost sailors would combine their tempest-tossed crafts for one more voyage. As they gazed out on a sea of tie-dye in the warm California afternoon sunlight, a wave of emotion rippled through the band. About to embark on a series of 5 concerts that would recapitulate and summarize a career shared with millions, the 7 members of this band arrayed themselves behind their instruments and bobbed, tumbled, and stumbled their way into a soft, rolling groove that picked up steam as it clattered to its feet. Lesch bounced lightly on his heels with a face wreathed in grins, while Weir's expression was set in a gaze of steely determination. Hart and Kreutzmann started out softly, Hart using brushes instead of sticks, slowly powering into the groove. Hornsby and Cementi, on piano and organ respectively, could barely be heard in the cacophonous sound mix. When the 3 vocalists stepped forward to sing the opening lines of Hunter's autobiographical calling card for the band, Truckin', the stadium erupted. When they hit the line, "What a long, strange trip it's been," the place went nuts all over again. Following with Uncle John's Band sent a warm, comforting signal to the Deadheads that Fare Thee Well would be a feast for the fans. When the band finally chugged to a stop, the song stretched out into a long, largely uneventful jam. The show had been running for a half hour. With the next selection, Alligator, a psychedelic-era Pigpen specialty, the band began serious archaeology as Lesch stepped forward with a wobbly, froggy lead vocal. Cumberland Blues gave the band a brisk but supple groove to explore. Weir sunk into the song like a knife. Lesch grinned as they smeared the harmonies out of pitch. The next 2 songs were authentic antiques. Born Cross-Eyed was a track from the band's 2nd album, Anthem of the Sun, that the Dead played only a handful of times in 1968, and Cream Puff War, a song that Garcia always hated off the 1st album, hadn't been performed since 1967. The first productive jam of the concert led to Viola Lee Blues, another staple from the ballroom days that had been abundantly reprised by Phil and Friends. Weir leaned hard into the song, and the band burbled along a driving rhythm they took through various detours. Gray clouds now covered the sky, and the stadium floor was dark, swept by spotlights. As the band neared the end of the lengthy jam, slowing into some quieter dynamics, the crowd inexplicably burst into cheers. The clouds had parted briefly, and, as a sign of the miracle that these concerts were, the storybook-perfect rainbow appeared in the sky above the eastern end of the stadium like a halo. The rainbow blazed its arc in the sky as all eyes in the stadium turned up. Unaware of the celestial event transpiring out of sight over their shoulders, the band played on. As the rainbow gradually melted back into the gray clouds, the jam slowly, deliberately disintegrated into a squall of squeaks and squawks and rolling timpani as the first set of Fare Thee Well came to its perfect ending. The lack of rehearsal showed. They had played plenty of bad notes and missed more than a few vocal cues. Harmonies could be iffy. Anastasio was timid, almost uncertain, not bold and assertive, and his solos never caught fire. At times, he quickly handed off the lead. They might stay on the same riff over and over. Hornsby and Cementi were tucked over on the side of the stage and almost entirely absent from the house sound mix. People probably forgot they were there, and the few solos Hornsby took were lost in the din. But Weir stoked the fire, continually lighting up the inside of the sound with propulsive strokes on his guitar that found the right spaces. He was singing like a man determined to elevate the stadium single-handedly, sometimes obviously straining his voice. Lesh, cheery and upbeat, braided his thumping bass lines around the beat. It was the two drummers, however, who made it sound like the Grateful Dead, like prize fighters who fought a busy, tough, but uncertain first round. The musicians retired to backstage for the set break. The second set dug even deeper into the psychedelic electro blues Dead catalog, a revisit to the band's 60s heyday, when the Dead held forth at Winterland, or Fillmore West, until the morning sun was in the sky. Cryptical envelopment led to Dark Star, long one of the Dead's signature pieces they would go years without playing, although it was standard fare for Phil and friends. A crushing St. Stephen and The Eleven gave way to Weir leading Turn On Your Love Light, a sequence immortalized on the Live Dead album. Hart and Kreutzmann took over for a 20-minute drums space that featured a lot of Hart's pre-recorded sonifications triggered from the bandstand. In the middle of the sonic interventions, Lesh moaned and warbled his way through What's Become of the Baby, a strange, unlikely piece of dissonance from Oxymoxoa in its live debut. The Other One and Morning Dew, two Fillmore-era standards, brought the show to a joyous, nostalgic close. Hornsby took the lead vocals on the encore, Casey Jones, the third song of the night from the Working Man's Dead album. The fans poured out of the stadium in dazed delight. The entire night had been devoted exclusively to songs from the 60s, Grateful Dead 101, the introductory course. Bob Weir bounced off the stage, pumped up and psyched. "Boy, I sure missed those stadium crowds," he said to Matt Bush as they descended the stairs. But Weir stormed out of backstage almost immediately. Nobody knew where he was, including his wife. It turned out that he was furious over the stage volume. Later that night, Weir reached Lesh on the phone and angrily complained about how loud he had been playing. His voice was hoarse from screaming over the band, and the old battle between them was reignited. Weir let him have it, and Lesh agreed to turn down. Of course, that would never happen. Day two was hours away. On Sunday, the next day, Roger McNamee accepted an offer of tickets from former NBA basketball star Bill Walton, possibly the best-known Deadhead, with more than 850 shows under his belt. McNamee, the tech investor who guided the Dead's aborted foray into the internet, had made his peace with the post-Garcia bands. As an experienced civilian Deadhead, he loved the music and the culture. But the scene in the audience was not the same as in Garcia's day. Knowing that the band had not had much time to rehearse, he figured it was better to skip Fare Thee Well than be disappointed. McNamee had been playing 100 concerts a year with his own band, Moon Alice, which entertained Deadheads on a regular basis. He kept a lot of connections to the Dead scene. John Molo was his drummer, Barry Sless his lead guitarist, and Jerry's friend Pete Sears played bass. Garcia's equipment manager, Steve Parrish, and several other members of the Dead's crew worked for Moon Alice. He had no plans to attend the Fare Thee Well shows until Walton called and insisted he come. McNamee had no idea what to expect. He went early to scope out the scene and found the parking lot merchants were enthusiastic but out of practice. Walking to the stadium, he started meeting people he knew from old Dead shows. Getting into the giant venue went like a breeze. He smoothly found his way to his seats in the crisp, clean white stadium and texted Walton, who came with passes, and took him to the roped-off friends and family viewing section on the field, in front of the soundboard and lighting console. In the little compound, he saw most of the guitar players from Phil and Friends and further. He said hello to Garcia's widow, Mountain Girl, who was down from Oregon with her daughters. He got a high five from Senator Al Franken, who hosted Dead concerts with his comic partner Tom Davis in the 70s when they were with Saturday Night Live. McNamee's brother had flown out with his kids. He was having a ball, and the music hadn't even started. It was just like a Grateful Dead show, he thought. Before the show, Kreutzmann climbed aboard a golf cart driven by his manager with a security guard on the back and tooled through the parking lots, handing out packs of cigarette papers, promoting his new book. Excited deadheads waved and shouted at him, gladly accepting his gifts. Word on the opening show had been good, and the second show was markedly better. The band was improving, not just show by show, but almost song by song, the musicians playing together better at the end of the concert than the beginning. From the first note the second night, the band was looser, more confident, more swinging, less uptight. After concentrating the night before on the Dead's earliest repertoire, opening with Feel Like a Stranger planted the band firmly in their 80s peak, reviving a frequent opening number from epic 80s Dead shows. Weir burned his way into the song, and Anastasio answered him with a verve and commitment he had been all but entirely lacking the previous night. Weir took a slashing, sterling bottleneck guitar lead on New Minglewood Blues, and Hornsby handled vocals on Brown-Eyed Woman. Weir howled Loose Lucy, serious as a judge, growling over the bar band riff, driving every line home as hard as he could. In his typical shorts and Birkenstocks, Weir acted like he was carrying the whole show on his back. Loser was a Grateful Dead song Hornsby felt enough affinity with to include routinely in his solo performances since his stint with the Dead in the early 90s, although he never performed it with the Dead, and he wrung out the elegance of the lyric with the band at Levi's. Row Jimmy, with its tricky extra two-beat phrase, fooled Anastasio every time, but Weir again poured himself into the song. The set hit critical mass with Alabama Getaway, a house-rocking rendition led by Anastasio on vocals. Weir slowed down the forlorn Black Peter to a death march and burrowed into the song with ferocity, picking a perfectly understated guitar solo into the first verse. He and Anastasio fired each other up in heated exchanges on the end of Hell in a Bucket to close the first set. Opening the second set with Mississippi Half Step, another frequent opening number during the 80s, plopped the band back into that rich era. Anastasio loose and agile on lead guitar, Lesh halting and uncertain on vocals. Weir's Wharf Rat led to an extended jam. Hornsby thought the Ravel-esque quality of his piano solo had been lost in the cavernous stadium, out of which the band emerged with Eyes of the World, which faltered only under Lesh's vocals. The band was cooking and dropped into a low groove for another Weir dirge beat on He's Gone, Weir punching every syllable, a song originally written about one of the band's managers, Steal Your Face Right Off Your Head. A joyful celebration of his departure, but now inevitably seen as a mournful paean to Garcia. This emotional high point swiveled into the nightly drums feature. The previous night, Hart and Kreutzmann had experimented with manufactured sounds and beats they drew from both their interests in electronic dance music, Deadtronica, but tonight Hart brought his Planet drum associate Sekiru Adipoju on the African hand drums, and the percussion symphony went world beat. The band broke out of the drums with I Need a Miracle into Death Don't Have No Mercy, another relic from the psychedelic era that even longtime deadheads like McNamee had never heard in concert before, and finally a jubilant Sugar Magnolia. To cap this Deadhead's dream second set, the band returned to encore with Broke Down Palace. McNamee wandered out of the stadium buzzed, bedazzled, and ecstatic. He ran into Howard Cohen, Mickey Hart's manager, and asked if there were any tickets available for Chicago. "Fuck yeah," said Cohen. McNamee got on his smartphone and quickly found hotel rooms in walking distance of Soldier Field. From what he just saw, he knew he needed to be there. And he knew Steve Parrish also had to come. The next stop was 4th of July weekend in Chicago. Chapter 22. Chicago. Signs hung from practically every bar. Welcome, Deadheads. Next to Soldier Field, the Field Museum of Natural History got into the act, draping the entrance with three giant banners of dancing tyrannosaurs wearing crowns of roses by psychedelic poster artist Stanley Mouse, who co-created the original Skull and Roses for the Dead. Old concert tapes blared from portable players. Deadheads in costume were everywhere. A truck selling Grateful Dead merchandise rolled through the loop, attracting crowds wherever it stopped. Hotel staffs dressed in Dead t-shirts. A local brewery produced an American Beauty Ale. Even the staid old Palmer House offered a special cocktail, the Deadhead, that mixed tequila, vodka, rum, and gin. Fare Thee Well hit town, and Chicago rolled over and played Dead. The chief attraction at Everything is Dead, the Field Museum exhibit mounted for the occasion, was Tiger, one of the guitars made for Jerry Garcia by Doug Irwin. The guitar was bought anonymously at auction by Hyatt Hotels heir Dan Pritzker of Chicago, leader of the rock band Sonia Dada. In addition to other Dead memorabilia, the field featured a large display of decorated ticket envelopes from GDTS2 in Stinson Beach. Jazz bands played Dead tunes in the museum atrium. Nightclubs were packed with aftershows featuring acts with known Deadhead appeal, like Railroad Earth, Carl Denson's Tiny Universe, Afrobeat rockers Antibalas from Brooklyn, a New Orleans R&B jam band featuring Papa Molly and Ian Neville. Jackie Green and Steve Kamok did a Garcia tribute. Garcia's mandolinist buddy, David Grisman, played a bluegrass brunch. Joan Osborne gave a matinee. Bars and restaurants all over town hosted pay-per-view screenings of the video feed from the sold-out concerts. The Chicago Tribune embraced the event in its editorial pages. "Yes, it's a big deal," they said. On Friday morning before the first show, Peter Shapiro met with Mayor Rahm Emanuel and thanked his honor for letting him bring the circus to town. Hotels were bursting. Occupancy was up 120% from the 4th of July the previous year, and rates jumped 77%. Tickets were selling for astronomical prices on the secondary market, $1,500 for obstructed view seats. VIP packages ran in the thousands. The New York Times noted the upscale nature of the event in an article headlined, "Grateful Dead fans replace VW vans with jets and the Ritz-Carlton." Among the most opinionated and entitled fans in rock music, some of the Deadheads raised objections to the massive commercial juggernaut. Stuart Solow, publisher of the Boulder Weekly, wrote a passionate article for Huffington Post that received a lot of attention, denouncing the ticket sale system, complaining about choosing Chicago as the location, and using Trey Anastasio on guitar. Wrote Solow, "It's worse than a pity. It's an outright tragedy that perhaps the most beloved band in history has put itself in a position to be remembered for participating in what may go down as the biggest money grab in music history." In characteristic openness, Shapiro reacted by locating Solow's cell phone number. They talked and emailed several times, and after consulting with Solow and others, Shapiro used a different system to sell tickets to the Santa Clara shows. He literally bought out the Ticketmaster allotment and sold every ticket by lottery through GDTS. Solow changed his tune. "I am convinced Peter Shapiro's heart is in the right place," he told the Washington Post. "And I don't think you can expect these guys to work for free." The band had canceled their original plans to fly out immediately following the last Santa Clara show. Instead, the musicians and their parties traveled separately to Chicago and assembled for tech rehearsal and sound check on Thursday at Soldier Field. Although the band had agreed on a press blackout before the show, Kreutzmann did a few interviews for his book on the condition that he didn't answer questions about Fare Thee Well. But, of course, he did.